It is Saturday, July 31st, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, Geek News. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
So you're living in a world that you don't know nothing about. Sitting at your keyboard paralyzed with doubt. So just sit tight, we're here to help you out. We don't know it all, but we'll tell you what we found out. And if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
And the latest technological innovations on your local public radio station. So if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
We are here each week, every week, for over 10 years now. Today in the air room, Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy, Stanford instructor and things like that.
Yo, yo.
Yo, yo, really?
Yo, 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 yo.
He's also the youngest one in the room. I don't know if you noticed.
Yes.
And Al Lucko is a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
The GeekSpeak theme today is by Michael Saunders, and if you'd like to participate by giving us your theme song, we'll play it on the air. Creative Commons Endeavor, which means you can reuse our show for anything you'd like as long as you give us accreditation. Who shall we start with today? It's nice to have everybody back. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, I've been gone for like a month.
Yeah.
And before that, I was gone for a month. And before that, I think I was gone for 3 months.
Before that, you were born.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I just covered. Let's talk about Chinese skyscrapers.
Oh, yeah. There's a... We had a story.
Wait, somebody has a story on that?
Yes, I have a story about that. Of course. Anything.
I just wanted to talk
just
about
name
that.
Anything.
All right,
yeah.
Go ahead.
A couple of weeks ago, I brought up some different ideas about wind power. And we got a lot of feedback from that. A lot of people really are into wind power and alternative sources of power. And this one of our listeners, Joe Johnson, sent in this link to me that is it's billed as the world's most energy efficient skyscraper, and it's in China, Guangzhou, China. It's the 2.3 million square foot Pearl River Tower.
It's really cool. It looks like a Pope hat.
There's just you can use all sorts of things to describe this thing. It is a very odd looking building. But one of the cool things about it is that at various parts in different floors, it has a area for accepting wind and then generating that into power. So it actually can – the building is powered by wind. I mean, it probably has supplemental power, but
– it's really hard to get out of the elevator on those floors, though.
It blows you. It's 309 meters. It's designed to direct the wind through these openings. So the whole skyscraper is built that way. It also has all these things like it's got a chilled ceiling system and double skin curtain walls, solar panels all over it. It's got daylight harvesting. It has a wastewater management system. It's, you know, 71 stories. It's not complete yet. They say it's supposed to be complete at the end of 2010, but I've seen a bunch of listings for it, and they have pictures of it. It is in progress. It looks like they're on schedule to finish it, but it's supposed to be just a great example of a building. The one little weird thing
let's talk about the building. The general idea is that this will be a zero consumption building.
Well,
right?
That's their idea,
so
is to make it
all its power for itself.
Yes, to be completely self-contained. You know, it's beautiful. It's reusing all their
beautiful is not very scientific.
No. Yeah, but I mean, they're it's not like some horrible looking contraption that you just destroys the environment.
Right.
That, you know.
And really, these intakes on the floors that you can see them from below, but they're not noticeable. I mean, It's not like distracting.
And they're pretty high up there. I don't know if they'd have any problems with birds flying through there, or I don't know whether, you know, there's all these this talk about, you know, the labor in China and whether it's the right kind of materials and all that kind of stuff. But from there,
but it's gonna be. I mean, it's gonna be a lot more space to work in the building. The building's gonna add more, you know, productive space for the. And it's a low impact on the environment.
It's a step in the right direction on paper. But then when you kind of look at it a little bit closer, you realize that the actual building is financed by the CNTC, Guangdong Tobacco Corporation.
Oh no! I guess they have the money in China right now.
They don't seem to mention anything about air quality within the building.
We can trust them, right? We can trust
them. That's what the turbines are for, just to clear out the air quality.
Yeah, so as long as you know they're trying, and it seems like a lot of the things they're doing right. I mean, you take what you can get, and as long as the building doesn't fall down, you know, it would be interesting to watch.
Thank you very much, Al. Mm-hmm. In the second, Miles is going to talk to us about electric vehicles. And, Al, you're going to talk to us about what's the youngest child or youngest person that could climb that building. But first, what's up with Kepler? Ben?
Kepler. Anyone remember the Kepler mission? I covered it about...
Oh, the mission. Oh, I thought you meant the actual scientist.
No, not... Well, like, he's been doing some really interesting things lately, you know, from his grave.
What's up with the Kepler mission?
The Kepler mission is a mission that we've launched in orbit around the Earth that's looking for exoplanets, and those are planets outside of our solar system. And we found quite a few of them without Kepler, and Kepler has some interesting ways of going about it. In a recent presentation, one of the co-investigators, Dimitar Sasolov, he actually said that we've actually found a lot of candidate worlds that are like Earth. And he wasn't supposed to necessarily make this announcement until February of next year. And a lot of times that's customary for people doing an investigation or doing science to kind of sit on the results so they can analyze it first.
Right.
Because they put all the effort into it.
Or you have cold fusion.
Yeah,
fiascos.
Let's not even start with that. During a talk that he gave at the TED Global Conference in the UK in Oxford, he very unexpectedly dropped that into one of the slides that he put in his PowerPoint. Of the number of planets that we've discovered through the Kepler mission is about 1,160. And we found that most of those are Earth-like sizes. Like roughly about the size of Earth.
Kepler's doing the Doppler effect on the sun, on the star.
It's doing the phase shift. The Doppler effect, Doppler shift. Yeah. So redshift, blue shift. I'm sorry. That's wrong. No, it's doing the occlusion. So
the
when
light detection.
So yeah, what happens is whenever this planet passes in front of the sun, in front of its star, then we see, because we're so far away and the star is so bright, we can't see the planet itself. We can't zoom in with a really high resolution optical camera or something because it's just completely eclipsed by the light of the star. But if we happen to be on the right plane relative to the system, then when the planet passes in front of the star, the light's star output appears to dip. It gets a little bit dimmer because the planet is in the way of the light and blocking some of the light.
It's similar to being in a forest and having a plane fly over.
You get this sudden shadow with the star.
So that's what it's doing, and most of the planets are actually Earth size or Earth-like?
Yes, that's really interesting about this. Yeah, it's interesting. The measurement they use is RE. I didn't have enough time to look that up. I assume that's one RE is probably the radius of the Earth.
Right.
Of the planets that they found that there were about 60 that were less than 4 radiuses of the Earth, but greater than 2. And they found 140 that were between, I guess, 0 and 2 Earth radiuses or radii. Which is really, really interesting considering that of the total number of planets that we got, most of them are roughly Earth size, you know, plus or minus 1 Earth radius. So that's really very interesting. That does not by any means. Well, first of all, none of this is actually officially verified by not released or verified by NASA, right? So NASA's going to have to look at these results, say we agree this seems like it was done right, and blah 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 blah. But as a preliminary result, it's pretty interesting. And the other thing I want to say is it's not saying that we found other Earths, not by any means. We're just finding things that are roughly the same size of Earth. That's all we're saying.
The reason it's so strange to me is that I would assume what they're doing is they're picking out a star and looking at it. But you've got to deal with the amount of time it takes the orbit to happen. Ours happens to be 365 years, right?
Years.
365 days. So you'd have to look at that star for a while for there to be importance to it. And then also you'd think that you'd be able to see a Jupiter-sized body a lot quicker than you'd be able to see an Earth-sized body.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, like you said, it's orbital time, right? So faster the planet goes around, the faster we can lock on to, this is a pattern, right? We can't just say, the sun's output, the brightness of the star appeared to dim for a second, so we can therefore infer there's a planet. No, we need to kind of wait for a couple orbital periods to determine that it's a cycle, that
it
happens.
And also assuming that most solar systems are that the smaller planets are towards the center because the gas has been blown
off. So they're going to be moving faster.
Right.
So
right.
In some ways, you could say that the Kepler mission was designed to be able to detect planets that are about Earth-sized or greater, not necessarily smaller than that. So the good news about this, the especially good news, is that it seems to be detecting things that are about Earth-sized. That's good news.
Right.
But again, you know, because it takes a really, really long time for something like Jupiter to go around the sun.
11 years.
Who knows? You know, maybe 11 years. Then we might be detecting maybe 1/11th of the planets that are out there.
All right.
But the exciting thing is we are finding a lot of these. And so an example would be something like Mercury or Venus or Mars. Those are all about the same, roughly the same size as Earth, you know, within that range.
Plus you have all those planets that are orbiting in the other direction.
The exoplanets.
Like around, because you have to be like crossing in front of
in the right plane,
But there could be things orbiting. I mean, it's a spherical object.
Luckily, you know? Because of the way the galaxy is shaped, most of the stuff spins on the same plane, I believe. So we have a similar plane for most of our local stars. Maybe I'm totally wrong.
You can kind of think of it as you've got a whole bunch of people on a mountain a mile away from you, and you tell them all, shine a laser beam in any random direction. How many of those people are going to be shining that laser beam right at you, right? So you're able to see it. Not very many of them, right?
But you shouldn't look directly at it.
That's an oversimplification, right? It's different.
Don't look at the laser beam.
Don't look at the laser beam.
So that's kind of the statistics that we're looking at here. We're not going to see by any means all of them. We're just going to see a very small slice of them.
Right.
But pretty cool. I mean, and also the other thing, Kepler's only been in, it launched, I think, March of 2009, and we covered that back then, so my memory's at least that good, remembering covering it on GeekSpeak. And it went into service several months later, so we've only had like a year to look at these planets out there, you know? So pretty cool.
Thank you very much. We're going to talk about the Chevy Volt. I think Miles got that. And we're also going to talk about climbing buildings. But first, we're going to get a little report from Alex. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Wow, we also got Lindsay over here.
Alex and Lindsay, wonderful. Welcome.
Good morning.
So where are you guys?
Right now, we decided to do this from our hotel room just to avoid the noise of the con in the background. And we probably wouldn't be able to hear you, and you probably wouldn't be able to hear us. But we are in Las Vegas at DEF CON.
And DEF CON is kind of a hacking conference. So is it a whole bunch of, like, illegal people?
Illegal people? I don't know if they're necessarily illegal people.
Or criminals?
You've got the feds and the criminals all in one place.
Yeah, I mean, they're not all criminals. A lot of them are just, you know, they are hackers for sure. I'm sure if they were active criminals, they wouldn't really be hanging out with the feds or, you know, showing their face too much at the conference. But, you know, a lot of them are the ones who find out the things that end up causing a lot of bad stuff. But at the same time, a lot of them find things that are not so bad or that are bad stuff, but we need to know about.
So I'm curious, how are you paying for this? Or do you have your credit card with you, ATM?
Yeah, really. Are you all cash?
You have to pay cash to get in. And you can't pre-purchase tickets or anything like that.
Why do you have to pay by cash?
I don't know, Alex.
It's for anonymity, really. They don't want you to have to disclose who you are in order to. In fact, they discourage having you disclose who you are when you kind of sign up for the con. So by paying cash, you don't have to have any sort of paper trail that you were there or anything like that.
Besides the thousands of photos that are up on Flickr.
Yeah, sure. You know, and with facial recognition and all that sort of stuff, I'm sure it's already been cataloged and identified.
So DEF CON is really the world's premier security conference. And it's FBI and a lot of intelligence agencies are there, and a lot of people that like to crack and hack. And there's even competitions to see how fast people can do certain things. Like, I remember a couple of years ago we covered how quick it is to break into certain OSs when they're locked down real tight. Is that kind of stuff happening there?
Oh, yeah.
Is this a room full of games like that going on?
Is this the one where the guy that bought all those ATMs showed everybody how he hacked them? Is this the conference?
Yeah, he put ATMs in the hallway, and people could look at them, as I recall.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't doubt that. I mean, here they've actually got one room that's just a bunch of different little contests, and then they've got another room that is what they call the Capture the Flag room, which is this huge room and tons of people, lights dimmed down, just the glow of computer screens lighting up their faces. I've got a great picture I'll have to share later.
Okay.
And but yeah, they're basically, this is the Capture the Flag room, and this year the major Capture the Flag competition is about social engineering and getting your way, getting information about a company. And I guess there's certain points you get for achieving certain goals or getting certain information about companies, and they've got certain rules and guidelines to try and keep it legal. You know, they don't want you. I think they're excluding financial companies, and there's certain rules about being able to get, you know, actual sensitive information, and you're not allowed to ask for, say, social security numbers, things like that.
But this is like trying to figure out the internal workings of a company from outside, which, of course, is crucial for social engineering. I mean, we learn a lot that the weakest point in the security system is a human being. And if you can get, Frank down in receiving to think that you work on the third floor, you can probably get in the building late at night. You know, there's ways of manipulating the system that really has to do with humans. Are social creatures. So that's the kind of thing that they're taking advantage of in the Capture the Flag room this year?
Yeah, well, exactly. And there's actually this great T-shirt I was tempted to get, but I went with a different one. And it says on the front, "I'm a social engineer." On the back, it says, "Because there's no patch for human stupidity."
Nice. So true, so true. Unfortunately, we're all pretty stupid when it comes down to it. The other things, there's kind of some art stuff going on there, too. There's, of course, the lockpicking conference. I mean, the seminar. You going to that?
I didn't go. I don't think I've put the lockpicking is on my list. Part of this is really for work. So I'm trying to pick tracks that are a bit more work related. We picked some tracks. Like, we went to one that was all about using the search engines for like Google and Bing and such for as a tool for. Doing a lot of the cataloging and identification of sites. Mm-hmm. It is actually, I mean, they mentioned it last year when I was here, but there's some interesting progression they've done in terms of how well they can target sites when they have new malware, targeting keywords that are popular in the moment, like, you know, some Lady Gaga song. And they use what they call black hat SEO in order to get malicious or websites that are basically trying to exploit vulnerabilities on web browsers, they get their websites up at the top of the list in Google and Bing. And even if it's for a short period of time, when it's hot, it could be millions of computers being exposed.
Right.
They're really good with that. They use it for targeting what websites already are high on the list or have high volume or have software that is vulnerable.
We didn't cover last week, but there was a major vulnerability about the favicon icon in Windows, and there's a patch out now to fix that. You're familiar with that leak or that vulnerability?
I've been a little out of it for the last few days in terms of the current vulnerabilities, but
basically one of the major problems with complex software, and browsers are pretty complex software, is that every once in a while there's a vulnerability, meaning that there's some kind of bug in the system that allows somebody remotely to enter in your computer and add a virus. This is why so many computers have viruses, because of these problems, these exploits. And what you're saying is that you're taking a conference, you're looking at this thing where the people that have this exploit that's going to infect your machine with a virus so that they can use your computer at their whim, they put up a website that seems to answer a certain question really well. It gets high up in the Google search. Then you search for puppy collars. They happen to be the first hit. You click on it. It's not really for puppy collars, but now your machine's infected with some virus. That's the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
Exactly. I mean, they use the search engines for all sorts of things, but yeah, that's the one of the key things that they've been doing. That's what they've been calling black hat SEO.
Yeah, and one of the concepts about DEF CON and hacking in general is that the more shared information that happens, the better the systems get. Right, so it's very common for hackers to figure out a vulnerability, say, hey, I figured out this vulnerability, please patch it, and then a company to finally fix the problem because of that hype and that public scrutiny. And Microsoft, for example, patches every, first Tuesday of the month to kind of respond to the cracks and the vulnerabilities that are found. Miles, do you want to say something? Oh, you look so good looking at me, so I just thought. Anyway, thank you very much. Lindsay, are you doing for work as well, or are you doing it on your own dime?
No, this is on my own dime.
Because you just like it.
Yes, I think it's fascinating, very interesting.
Well, I like that both of you are there. Alex Lias and Lindsay Lani are down at DEF CON in Vegas, and it's the largest annual hacker convention, and it's been going on since 1993. And do you know how many people are there this year?
I've gotten a whole lot. It's chaos at times. They're actually doing a really good job at organizing the lines, but
cool. It's
crazy how many people are here.
In 2008, there was 8,500 people, so it's a pretty big conference.
They'll probably release the numbers later.
Yeah, and when you come back, share some more stories, and thanks for calling up.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, take care.
Thanks a lot.
I wonder if all the slot machines are on extra warning watch or something with all these hackers in town, like if all the casinos are like, hey, by the way.
Slot machines are pretty bulletproof,
though. This week is different.
Yeah.
I think if I lived near that conference, I would probably just unplug my router while everyone was there, because everyone would be hacking it and getting in my network and looking around and seeing what they could find.
You know, that's pretty common in most conferences if you go with laptops. So someone's normally there kind of taking a peek at people's security, any conference, because it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, but this one?
This one is
everyone
insane.
Is. This not just matter like, what
you do. You shouldn't even bring your computer in the building.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Or leave it turned off, you know?
let's go ahead and take Miles, please tell us about the vault.
Well, actually, I was going to talk about different regulations regarding either electric vehicles or hybrids, and the Volt being one of them, 2011 Chevy Volt. You've got the 2011 Nissan Leaf, and in 2012, you've got the new updated plug-in hybrid Prius. So very exciting times with regard to alternative vehicles. But the legislation is a little weird here, because one of the incentives to getting these on the road are, for example, federal tax breaks, state tax breaks,
right.
The ability to drive in the carpool lane, the HOV lane. And they are competing already on price in terms of having low lease agreements per month. But the Volt just doesn't seem to be getting any love from California legislators.
Why?
Well, it comes into look at the technology a little bit. The Leaf is an all-electric vehicle. It has a 40-mile range, give or take. Or
depending. Yeah.
Depending. But
this vehicle, you never actually have gas that go into the car, ever.
Right.
Right.
And that one is non-ambiguous. It doesn't have a tailpipe. And so California legislators are putting forth a $5,000 rebate. Say, like, hey, there you go. Or rather, and they can drive in the HOV lane, right? However,
what's
it doesn't
HOV stand for?
I actually don't
know. Okay, I'll look it up while you're talking. Go ahead.
Okay. An acronym I don't know. Who knows?
I know.
Who
would have
thought? Whereas the Chevy Volt, because it has a gas engine, Chevy Volt has a large electric battery. It allows it to go a slated 40 miles on a single charge, just like the Leaf does, except that it has an assist gasoline engine, which is no different from what you'd expect from a generator. It's a small generator, very small, smaller than the Prius engine, that it's just charging up the electrical system so that it can go. It does not have permission to drive in California's HOV lanes.
And HOV stands for High Occupancy Vehicle. I thought we were going to do the same time.
High occupancy vehicle. Sorry, it's that 10-second delay thing.
Yeah, it must be.
I think I got it before you, though. I was watching you.
I think you did, yeah.
So while it can get the $7,500 federal tax credit, it can't get the state rebate.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is because the legislators are going, well, it doesn't really have really great emissions. But they're allowing the new plug-in hybrid Prius to going to the HOV lane.
Well, is this engine really bad emissions engine? I mean, my lawnmower has got pretty bad emissions, but it's a low power.
But they're not taking an average. They're not taking an average over
right.
a
mileage.
Time.
They're just talking about run the engine right now. Interesting.
Right. So if you're going 40 miles, it's no different than a Leaf, than the Nissan Leaf. The Prius plug-in hybrid slated for 2012, that can drive in the HOV lane, even though at highway speeds, its gas engine must always be on.
Whereas which vehicle is it?
The Toyota Prius, right. The plug-in.
So couldn't Prius. What's the Volt? Couldn't you just have like a big orange fluorescent cork you put in the tailpipe and then you drive in the lane? Like, I'm running on electric right
well,
now.
That's the funny thing is that if you're going a short distance but getting on the freeway, at those highway speeds, the Volt is zero emissions.
Right.
Whereas the Prius must be gas assist and
at that high speed. So basically the average commute of a person, which is normally less than 40 miles a day, the Prius is going to be much more emissions than the Volt.
Right.
But they're not going to allow the Volt to do it.
Right. Unless they change the legislation a bit to switch that out. So it's a curious little labyrinth of features trying to figure out how a device is going to be eligible for tax credits and have them incentivized for people to buy. But it doesn't really jibe with the technology.
All right. Well, thanks for that. And I want to talk about high occupancy vehicle as the designated the acronym, the TLA.
Three other acronym.
It's no longer an AIDK.
It's not?
No.
Okay. What's
an acronym? I don't know. Or AIDK.
That isn't either. No.
LOL.
ROTFL. It's gone down. I was going to say is that motorcycles can drive in it. Vehicles that have like the Prius can drive in it.
As long as they have a sticker.
Right, but a motorcycle can drive in it by one person. That's not a high-occupancy vehicle in any sense of the word.
And actually, my motorcycle doesn't really get that good a gas mileage.
It
actually.
Doesn't?
It's like, you know.
It's 60 miles a gallon?
Well, I mean, I've seen cars that get better gas mileage than it. So
really?
Just because it's a motorcycle doesn't mean it gets a great gas mileage.
No, but you can't normally carry that many people on the freeway with it.
No.
Yeah. Safely.
Let's go on with the show, shall we, folks? I'm still curious about climbing skyscrapers, but we'll let that wait till after the break. All right. Today in the air room with me is Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow, Miles Elam. We also had Lindsay Lonnie and Alex Leas call from DEF CON down in Vegas, the hacking conference. God, how geeky are we? We've got some cred. Yeah. I mentioned before that Miles is a programmer. I mentioned that Ben does he does video editing and also teaches a lot about software. And Al is a designer, fluent in all the design tools of Adobe and such like that. And we mentioned this, and I almost never talk about what I do, but I am a geek for high-tech art. So I support artists making crazy art like robotic stuff. And, we could go into that. But we all have a little bit of street cred. And the reason I bring that up is that we had a listener call us or email in and says that one of the things, I'll quote, "One of the things I like most about your program is that before you begin to comment or give advice on anything, you list the credentials of every person in the room, most of which includes substantial programming knowledge." Miles. "This way, the average listener can feel confident that you know what you're talking about. It's one of the things that simply call when it's one thing to simply call oneself a geek. It's another to actually have the know-how." And he goes in to talk about how a lot of articles are written in the geek space, the software space, even about like a 99 Subaru, you expect a person to have a real knowledge and a real understanding, and they don't necessarily. So he just wanted us to comment about that. You guys have any? Here, I'll read his question. "How important is it for the technology media to have the knowledge of these fundamental concepts so crucial to the design phase?" So what they're talking about is the general understanding of being a geek, like that we can talk about how electricity works, we understand that, how a gas engine works, how the fundamentals of like a hybrid system, what's actually going on. We kind of have a base level understanding. Is that important for someone to cover a news story about, for example, the new Prius or the Volt?
Well, speaking for myself, this is Miles. I have a degree in modern literary studies, so I am a lit major, in addition to being a programmer, professional programmer for many years. With regard to computer science, there are many things that I could comment on. There are a lot of things that I couldn't because I don't know the math. Computer science is basically applied mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And however, we're talking about computers many times. So if you're talking about what type of laptop to get or how to get your system free of viruses or things like that, a computer science degree actually doesn't help with that at all. It's not meant for it. A computer science degree is math, and that's it. If you want to talk about the state of the art for heuristics for how you make a virus detection engine, computer science could have something to say for that. And then there's also the side of, if you're talking about astronomy, physics, you know, theoretical physics, things of that nature, no one person, unless they have a degree in all of those areas, is going to be able to speak intelligently about all of those topics to the level that some might expect or want. So in many ways, we do cover things from a layman point of view, admittedly layman that have spent a great deal of time thinking about those topics.
Let me mention that he mentions in this, Jared mentions in his email about the antenna gate, you know, the iPhone's antenna, and the problem is that it's an engineering problem, of course, to make an antenna that's really good, but it's also a design issue, and I don't think we addressed like the actual complexities of this, but he kind of talks about as a metaphor that if you took a 99 Subaru and you removed the engine and put a Ferrari engine in it, you're not going to expect it to go 150 miles an hour. Like, the systems are complex. They integrate with each other. And that a lot of that whole debacle to some degree about how the iPhone antenna for the 4, it was really bad, and this kind of media explosion, most of the people that are covering the story don't really know what's going on. And so to talk about it intelligently is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of get that. I mean, most people I interact with don't understand like how RF works, but yeah, I think it's an interesting idea.
But you have some training in it. You have training in electronics,
so I can talk about it relatively. But not. I mean, basically, what I can kind of say is that it's a complicated thing to try to smack an antenna. The best way to make a cell phone with really good reception is to stick an antenna up the top of it. But no one seems to want that anymore.
If you were an electrical engineer with an emphasis on radio frequency, then you'd be able to design the thing. But I like to think that you have enough knowledge, enough background, that you can comment on it, even if you're not the actual designer.
You know, before Antenna Gate happened, before it even hit the street, when they talked about the antenna, when they talked about the phone coming out and they showed the black bar, that he showed like where the frame of the iPhone was split to, because there was different antennas, my first reaction was, yeah, but your hand's going to interfere with that. Like, that was my first thought. And I just was like, because it's aluminum, you know. I normally think of, you can get a lot of, if you ever play with micro transmitters, which I did a lot when I used to bug my friends and neighbors and such. When I say bug, I mean electrical surveillance bugging. Anyway, when your hand goes around a radio, it really messes up the signal, the transmitter. And so I just assumed that it would be problematic. But the actual context, being able to touch the metal that's actually the connector thing, that seemed like a really big problem. You'd be able to short it out. That was my first reaction. And then I was like, well, I'm sure they figured that out. Right? I didn't think much about it. But clearly they had a problem with design. And, of course, all the people that were using those phones at Apple, they all had to have cases on them because they need to hide the fact that that device existed. So because they had a case on it, nobody was testing it without the case. Which, of course, alleviates the
problem. Or unless they were doing it on the Apple campus, which has very good cell reception, because it's in the middle of Silicon Valley.
Of course, yeah.
Another thing is that there are definitely levels of expertise with all of these things, but there are levels of expertise. We're not necessarily, I would never cover an astronomy story and say, I know about this, even if I've done a lot of reading about it. You know, maybe I am closer to that level of expertise than someone who hasn't read anything about it or doesn't think about it a lot. But there's definitely expert, and then there's someone who's a geek about it, you know, but not necessarily someone who studies it. And that's definitely what we are. And then the other thing is, when we're covering stories, how much information can we actually get about it? What kind of, like, right. One of the things I find is, when I cover stories, I want to know, like, technically how, like, the next story I'm going to cover, technically how did they do it, you know? What were the tools they used? What were the methods they used? And when you read about these stories, a lot of times when they're popularized or they're put on websites like the BBC, I mean, they have good science reporting, but they're not talking about really how it works necessarily. Right. They're making it accessible for the majority of their readers.
And what we normally do when we read a story like that is we try to infer how it actually works.
Yes. Right? So certainly all of our commentary should come with that grain of salt.
Right. I remember reading that. This is Al. I remember reading that that story when, or that email when it came through. And, you know, there's a certain balance, too, about something to be interesting. If you look at a lot of the people who report on technology, Walt Mossberg, mm-hmm. for example, from the Wall Street Journal, not the biggest technical mind, but what he does is he actually looks at it from a layman's point of view and says, well, does this make sense? And,
right.
and he goes into a little bit. And I think in a lot of my work, I do so much user experience and user interface design. I have to sort of back off from the engineering side of it. And I don't really want to know everything about the program because I can't relate to an average person that way.
Right.
I can't design something. All the engineers all know how everything works. And, oh, yeah, well, that button, of course, does that. Well, you know, people don't know that, you know. And so you have to kind of switch things around. So in
you're,
a way,
you're more of the bridge of our subject.
Yeah, I'm
right?
trying to bridge it a little bit more yeah. so that it's interesting. And it also is you know, it's palatable to a lot of people. And this is how they're going to see it, you know.
And Jared, there's a little bit of a discussion about this. And I just want to say one other thing that, of course, you're preaching the cry here. I think that everybody should have more technical chops, right, to have a little bit more understanding of how the world works. When you start doing that, a lot of the foo-foo stuff kind of dissipates and gets uninteresting because it's more fiction without a lot of learning capability. So, yeah, I think that reporters should have highly technical skills.
There's also one other thing I wanted to say, which is that a lot of topics you don't actually go and study, right? Especially with computers, right? If you're being put in a position where you're helping someone attach their printer to their computer, it's not that you're an expert in how printers work and how computers work and the communication protocols and all of that necessarily. It's that probably what would help you even more and would be easier to attain is experience with that. Right. So if we're talking about astrophysics, I mean, none of us are an expert in astrophysics. A lot of us read a lot about it, but we're not experts and we don't have training. But with regard to computers and helping people with computers and commenting on the state of some of things, sometimes you don't necessarily have that ability to get training in it or, you know, go and study it in a university or something. You can gain experience and you know, have relevant things to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thank you. I think we covered that pretty well. That was the geek bit today, by the way.
Oh.
A little long, but all right.
Retroactive all right. introduction.
So, Al, the skyscraper that you mentioned, could somebody climb it?
Well, it depends. If your name is Hibiki Kono, maybe, because this kid... He's 13 years old, and he created a thing. He took two, basically, they're vacuum cleaners. They're 14.98 Tesco valve vacuum cleaners, but they're vacuum cleaners.
They're vacuum cleaners.
And he connected them to these little pads, and he's able to scale walls with these things. He did it in his class at school. It's in Cambridge,
Mass.
And no, it's in the UK. They call it the lad is a big fan of Spider-Man.
Oh, so. that other Cambridge.
Yes, that one. And it's pretty cool. They show a video of him climbing it, and he's climbing a brick wall. It's not like this glass wall where you're just, you know, he's climbing a brick wall with these pads, going, you know, scaling it, and it's connected to a power cord that he's able to, you know, climb up the wall using this thing. And he's quoted as saying, "My mom thinks it's brilliant, but she won't let me use it in my bedroom as she's worried I might pull down the ceiling."
Good point.
And she also has a limit as to how high he can go. But, you know, in his school, it shows that, you know, they put like cushion, like a big pad underneath him. And then he just goes up this wall, this brick wall with this cord. And these vacuum cleaners just goes
right
up the wall.
When you say cord, like he needs to have it plugged in.
It needs to be plugged in.
All right.
So, I mean, it's, you know.
So to climb the skyscraper, basically, he'd need his mom to turn the other direction.
Yes.
He'd get a really long extension cord.
Yes.
He'd be set.
But it would be neat. And to just, you know, 13-year-old kid doing this,
it's
everybody,
cool.
everybody, when he said he was going to do this, all their teachers, you know, I don't know if you really, this isn't a very good project. And, you know, but then he actually just kept going at it, and he proved it could be done.
Very cool. And, of course, he's using, like, a rope from the suction cup, which he's using by his hands, rope going down to his foot. So he's... You know, holds up his weight on one leg and mm-hmm. then raises the other, and then mm-hmm.
right.
I was gonna say, otherwise this kid's
climber.
Really
yes,
strong,
really yes. burly,
like
yes. just by arm strength.
Yeah, arm strength. And
all right, cool. Thank you. I was hoping for that. I'm sad that it's powered by plug-in.
Well, you know.
Well, I guess if you had a really burly person, you could attach a really big battery to them.
I guess.
And then you just have a certain amount. You just have to make sure you're down by the time the battery expires.
Or solar panel, wait for noon and just go.
Well, but then the clouds come in and you're like, oh, no.
Yeah.
And you fall.
A couple capacitors to help out. All right. Thank you very much, Al. Ben, what's going on with Facebook this week?
Oh, Facebook. Favorite topic to, oh, geez. So This is just kind of a story that reiterates in my mind the importance of people understanding privacy and how important it really is. Because what just happened this last week, I think on the 27th or 28th or something, so a hacker from school security, the school security group named Ron Bose, he basically created a program, a web crawler program, and it goes through and looks at all of the public pages on Facebook's site. So that's anyone who has set their security so that way anyone can access certain things about them, right? Be it their name, maybe their address. A lot of people actually have all of that stuff completely public. And he went through and scraped all of that, harvested all of that data, put it into a big file, 2.8 gigabytes, and put it up on a BitTorrent site. So anyone at all can get to it.
Now, you wouldn't think that's a big deal because Google, of course, can get to it if it's
public. Yeah, something to definitely reiterate with the story is that all of this data was actually public. So you can get to it without downloading this torrent file. He just has made it really easy for you because he's written the script to snatch all the data. And this is 171 million entries, and all those entries relate to over 100 million individual users.
But and then over time, I've noticed that Facebook changes its rules.
Yeah,
about what's public and what's not public.
So that's what's really interesting. The problem is not that someone got all this together, scooped it up, and made it public. That's not at all the problem, and it's not at all illegal because all this data is public. But the problem is that it's public to begin with. The problem is that anyone in the world can go to Facebook, look up your profile if you're one of these. I mean, one in five users is in this file. Over one in five users. So that's the problem. It's that as Facebook has evolved, they've several times, you know, popped up a thing on the homepage saying we've changed our privacy security settings. Go change yours and do whatever. But the thing that they oftentimes wouldn't be very clear about is if, let's say, I went on my Facebook page and I set my privacy settings so they suited me, so people couldn't get to my information. And then Facebook decided, you know what, there's this big hubbub about privacy. We're going to go ahead and change the way we do it. They pop up the thing on the page and I think, oh, it's okay. I've already set my privacy settings. I don't need to go and check. But what Facebook has done in the past is rolled back your privacy settings to defaults,
which is
extremely dangerous. Yeah, defaults. The default security settings are what
Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg, yeah. It's what he and the people, other people who work at Facebook and the higher ups think the default for privacy should be, which is definitely very skewed towards Facebook working. Facebook works if people are open with their data. It works better and better and better if as people are more and more open, right? But if people are all closed, then it's more difficult to acquire new users, things like that.
Well, so just to pipe in, I don't know that it's necessarily dangerous that it's moved to the different settings, but what's at issue is that people aren't expecting it, and
yeah,
that's dangerous.
Yes, exactly. If they made it very clear, if you've changed privacy settings in the past, you need to go in and change them again because we've reset them. That's okay. But then the other thing is, what if someone doesn't know how to change their privacy settings? Or they think, oh, I'm not a geek. This is over my head. I'll just leave it because I trust Facebook because they have all of my photos and my family's on there, right? That's when it becomes really dangerous for me when the layman thinks I trust Facebook.
That's the area where I have more of the issue with Facebook is because if you went out to the street and started interviewing random people walking by, most of them honestly will not be able to tell you what a web browser is. I'm sure many people listening in there are going like, well, I kind of know it's the internet, right? It's that lack of knowledge about the problem space,
right,
that you can't even engage in an intelligent dialogue about it. It's not because people are dumb. It's because they're concentrating on other things in their life. Mm-hmm. Even though I spend some time working in the garden, I'm not a gardener. Someone we're talking about, what's the best seed for this? And I'm going to be doing this. And
well, a great example of this is just changing your oil. I mean, it used to be that everybody changed their own oil. Now we take it places. If I needed to change my oil, it would take me three or four times as long as what I would normally be able to do it if I did it all the time.
Like, right.
Just,
and do you
I
know,
don't have the expertise.
Yeah, and do you know which weight of oil to get specifically
I
for
have a
friend's
car? So yeah, I do. Oh, for a friend's car?
For a friend's car. Like no. Some friend goes up, and what type of oil should you get?
Right.
And this
and
is something
not
that
about
would be
being
obvious.
Stupid. It's just not necessary.
Yeah. It would be obvious to some people who spend their time doing it all the time. Mm-hmm. privacy settings on Facebook and web applications are obvious to us because we use it all
the time. I don't know.
Last
time I changed my Facebook security stuff, it was kind of complicated. Friends of friends. That's probably not a good group to trust applications with. Yeah. You know, like I had to kind of go through it.
You had to do some mental acrobatics to figure out what they were talking about.
Yeah, because it's kind of an obscure idea.
Oh, absolutely.
I think the biggest thing to do on Facebook, and it's always been kind of the case, is don't put stuff on it. Like don't put your address. Don't put your phone number. And if your friends are involved in Facebook and you want them to be able to contact you, they can text you in through the system. You know, they can send a message to you and you can respond to them. But then again, that's... I don't do that.
It depends on the person. I guess the rule of thumb we have here is if you're unsure, don't put anything up there that you wouldn't want everyone on the world to see.
Yeah, that includes phone numbers, addresses, what's your favorite pet's name? Oh, well, funny, your bank asks you that as a security question, you know?
Right, like, don't put your pet's name. Or hometown. Like, everybody has their hometown. It's like that's one of the security questions for banks.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, absolutely.
You know, mother's maiden name, not a hard thing to do because your mom joins Facebook if she's around, if you're lucky like me. Mm-hmm. And of course, her middle name's her maiden name because she wants her high school friends to find it.
Yeah,
it's only a click away. You know, it's bad.
Yeah, it's bad. And the other really insidious thing about this is that when they would roll back those privacy settings, it wouldn't just be from that point on things were public that you had initially said weren't going to be public. It was retroactively.
Everything you already posted.
So you post something, let's say in February, that you want only your friends to know or only someone to know or something like that. And then in March, Facebook rolls back their privacy settings and you think, oh, I've already done that. Even if it takes you a day to go in, for a day, that thing that was supposed to be private back in February is public. So
it gets
scraped
by 50 things.
It's very, very dangerous because I don't think Facebook is a company that means to be insidious, but they're in a very, very sensitive situation where they can just, you know, do one little thing and 500 million people's data is
available. To be clear, we've always had this problem. We've always had groups of friends where there's that one person we didn't like, right? And we're like, we don't really be a part of them. But, you know, they ask your friend what your phone number is, and the person gives it to them because we all hang out on Tuesdays, right? So this has always been a social problem. It's just magnified
tremendously
by having an infinite amount of people. Well,
especially
6
with
billion people.
Things like spam bots that can harvest things really, really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You know, your friend isn't going to be able to look at...
The thing that I find frustrating is that because information is so good, banks and security places that you really need your privacy to be kept, like your medical information stuff, there needs to be better security patterns. I hate the idea that they ask me 5 questions that are like, what's your pet's name? What's your mom's name? That pattern doesn't work for me. What I want them to do is I want them to say, what's your public ID? You know, what's your public key? And I'm like, yeah, this is my public key. If, you know, encrypt everything.
Security key.
Yeah, do it right. But of course, that's too complicated.
Yeah, but once again, you're hitting into the area where we understand public key infrastructure.
Yeah.
We understand having a public key, private key pair. And
of course,
that.
I like the idea of being able to use the ATM easily, but I can't stand this 4-digit PIN.
Yeah.
Every time I use it, I'm like, Arr. My old bank supported it, you know, a long digit PIN. I had like a 15 digit PIN. And everyone's like, why does it take you so long? I said, it's a long PIN. But now it's 4 digits, and there's not that many 4 digit numbers. And
There is 9,999.
This and other fun facts from Al.
Right. I figured that out myself.
Let's go ahead and go to Santa Cruz, which is where we are, and talk to Chuck. Welcome to GeekSpeak. I have the wrong pod up, don't I? Yes, I do. Hey, Chuck, how's it going?
Good. I'm making movies off the screen of a graphics-intensive application. It's an Earth visualization application.
Okay.
And so
is it
the application
Google Earth?
Itself is using lots of CPU.
Okay.
And I'm using currently Cam Studio to do off the screen.
Camtasia? You mean?
Pardon me?
Camtasia or Cam Studio?
Cam Studio.
Cam Studio.
Okay.
And it's just a little screen grabber type of thing, and it'll save into various movie formats. I'm currently getting, I think it reports 7 or 8 frames a second, and I'd really like to get 20 or 30 frames a second.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand, you know, it's trading off with my application, which is hogging everything.
What kind of computer do you have?
It's an XP, a Dell, you know, maybe about 3 years old. It's pretty powerful. It's 2 CPU, but...
How much RAM do you have?
4 gig.
Okay, so your system can probably handle this. What kind of resolution are you running your visualization app on?
It's 1024 by 600, and it kind of needs to be that way.
Yeah, well, that's not bad resolution, but that is a big video file. Because what you're basically doing, if you're doing a... So video is kind of complicated. The way it's compressed, you have to have multiple frames to actually get any kind of compression out of it. Mm-hmm. So it's a delayed thing. And when you're dealing with a delayed thing, of course, you've got to – it depends on how the capture software is written. I would assume that the capture software is written that you have is not extremely good, only because you should be able to do this on that system.
Yeah, you might want to look into Camtasia because that – you know, and it's available for PC and Mac.
Yeah,
it's actually mostly a Mac. I mean, the thing that's PC,
nice,
I think.
The thing that's nice about CamStudio, of course, it's open source and it's therefore free, and that's a nice thing. But what I would recommend, because I've got another hardware solution for you in a second, but what I recommend is going and trying one of these other apps that will let you try it for a little while and see what kind of resolution before you buy it. It'll have some watermark across the thing that says the name of their company, you know, as you play with it. See if that works better. If you still have the same problem, the other thing you can do is try to reduce the amount of resources your machine's running. There's actually a lot of tasks going on that you can
kill. Yeah, I've done that.
Kill. Okay. So I would try a different software package, because that software package should not be that great. The other thing is where it's using the software capture, where it's using its cache, you really want to use that on a separate hard drive if you've got a separate hard drive. If you don't have a separate hard drive, that might be a cheaper hardware solution, but it might not fix the problem. The last suggestion is...
Wait. Last one, you said store the cache on an external hard drive?
Oh, sorry.
It may let you change that. It may not.
So the software package is going to be recording all these images of the screen grab, right, and has to put it somewhere fast. And so I'm running out of time. We'll continue this conversation online. Go ahead and send us an email, okay? Sorry.
And I'll post a link to Camtasia, too.
Yeah, I know about that. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thanks, Miles. Wow. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market now offers organic raspberries grown in the coastal climate and soils of Watsonville, harvested yesterday and in-store today. Whole Foods Market in Monterey, Santa Cruz, and in Capitola, across from the Capitola Mall. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage recovery. This is GeekSpeak, which is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence, and it's used with permission. My name's Lyle Troxell. Here's the USB of the week.
Hi, this is Al Luckow with GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. Warning, the following USB device is for mature audiences only. Now that I think about it, though, it's really for immature audiences. And I also want to mention, people send this one in to me a lot. I've just been avoiding it. Anyway, here goes. Yeah, sometimes you think you have it all, but I'm here to tell you that you really don't. You can find this one at stupid.com. Yes, you heard that right. The USB pole dancer. Yep, plugs into your USB port, and when music plays, she gyrates around the pole. What a great addition to your desk, huh, guys? The ladies in your office will surely be impressed by your appreciation of the art of burlesque. The USB pole dancer stands about 11 inches tall and requires no batteries. Because, you know, it's a crazy USB device. It's real, and you can see the link up on geekspeak.org.